throw them into a gunny sack, carry them out on her back in a moonlit night, dig a grave in the yard, and throw the troublesome bundle into the hole without a tremor. Basing his analysis on a newspaper photograph of Belle's face, Dr. J. M. Fitzgerald, an expert in character study, judged her to be a woman of selfish and domineering will, masculine resolution and power of mind, and an instinct for killing, as shown in the base of her brain, which is remarkably expanded. To Dr. S. V. Rehard of Washington, D.C., the same photograph served as a practical illustration of the truth of phrenology. It shows a practical, matter-of-fact intellect combined with ingenuity or constructiveness, large destructiveness, secretiveness, and acquisitiveness, with a large development of the social nature and a small development of the moral and religious qualities. With her power to plan and devise, combined with her social nature to entrap her victims, and her executive nature to carry out her plans without moral restraint or sympathy, we have just the kind of character to commit the crimes with which she has been charged. A very different conclusion was reached by Dr. Charles Jones of Austin, Belle's family physician back when she was Mrs. Mads Sorensen. Though not an alienist by training, Jones claimed to be a conscientious student of the psychology of crime. In his view, Belle was a religious fanatic whose atrocities were motivated by the same spirit as prompted tortures and burning at the stake in the name of religion in the Middle Ages. In my psychological studies, Jones explained, I have observed that religion is not restraining in a moral sea. Religion is not the same as ethics. Religion in its fanatic state may be a passion devoid of morality that will take any means to an end. Already unhinged by religious eccentricities, Belle was launched on her unparalleled career of crime after murdering Mads and collecting on his insurance. The sudden wealth that came to her, Jones opined, may have had an irresistible suggestion of the ease with which money might be obtained. In the incident of her husband's death, her temptation to commit the alleged atrocities may have had its birth. The most illustrious figure to weigh in on the issue of Belle's mental state was Cesare Lombroso, nowadays dismissed as a crackpot, but in his own time, the world's foremost criminologist. In his enormously influential book, L'Uomo Delinquente, Criminal Man, Lombroso argued that violent criminals were not merely barbaric in their behavior, but were literal atavisms, savage, ape-like beings born by some hereditary glitch into the modern world. With their jutting brows, big jaws, thick necks, and other supposedly telltale features, violent criminals were evolutionary throwbacks, specimens of humanity in its most degenerate state. In a piece on the Ganesse case widely reprinted in American newspapers, Lombroso argued that the Laporte murderess was a prime example of what he called the born woman criminal. Such beings, he noted, generally commit fewer crimes than men, but when they are criminal, they are considerably more so than men. It is not enough for a woman to murder an enemy. She wants to make him suffer, and she enjoys his death. Like others of her breed, who always mix eroticism with crime, Mrs. Ganesse must have used the attraction of sensuality to obtain her victims. Her exaggerated and perverse sexual instincts manifested themselves in murdering the beings who should have been most dear to her, and she found in this a strange satisfaction. In the slaying of her children, Lombroso saw another element common to such criminals. In these unnatural females, the maternal instinct, which is conspicuous in the normal woman, is not only suppressed but reversed, as it becomes in them a pleasure to torture their own offspring. The explanation for such behavior offered by the great criminologist was breathtaking in its combination of rank misogyny, pseudoscientific blather, and fundamental incoherence. Woman has many traits in common with a child. Like it, she is vindictive and jealous. Only in ordinary cases, these defects are naturally neutralized by piety, by maternity, by less ardor in the passions, by weakness, and by undeveloped intelligence. But if there is diseased excitement of the psychic centers, which intensifies the bad qualities and seeks a vent in evil, if pity and maternity are absent, If strong passions are also present, the desires derive from an intense eroticism, a sufficiently developed muscular force and a superior intelligence for doing evil and carrying it out are present. The born criminal appears, and the woman will be more terrible than any male criminal. Far more persuasive were the insights offered by an unnamed specialist, cited in a widely circulated article by noted journalist Arthur James Pegler. Placing her in the proper criminological category, this person saw Mrs. Ganess as a maniac of the much dreaded type that includes the Whitechapel murderer. It is not money that drives such killers, but the constantly growing appetite for blood, to cut deep and watch the blood flow, to dabble the hands in it, to revel in the odor of it. One distinguishing features of these criminals is their invariable use of the same methods in every case. Mrs. Ganess decapitated every one of her victims. In every case, she severed the limbs. Always, there was a maximum of mutilation. In comparing Bell to Jack the Ripper, as a murderer driven by bloodlust and employing a signature M.O., this anonymous expert accurately identified her as the type of homicidal maniac for which no name had yet been coined, what a later age would call a serial killer. 22. Johann and Kate. During the post-mortem on Andrew Helgelein, his stomach, liver, and kidneys were removed, hermetically sealed in a jar, and sent to Dr. Walter S. Gaines of the Rush Medical College at the University of Chicago. Gaines would ultimately report that he had found nearly 1.5 grains of strychnine in the stomach, a quantity sufficient several times over to have produced death, along with a considerable amount of arsenic. It was, of course, impossible to say precisely how Bell dispatched her victims. Gaines's findings, however, combined with the condition of the various skeletal remains, suggested one plausible scenario. After consuming a last home-cooked, poison-laced meal, Bell's victim would soon be in the throes of an agonizing death. Wielding a hatchet or cleaver, she would put him out of his misery with several bone-splintering blows to the skull. She would then drag the body into her cellar abattoir for butchering. Once the head and limbs were removed from the trunk, she would package the separate parts in gunny sacks, haul them into her hog lot, dump them in a hole, and add quicklime to facilitate decomposition. How many victims suffered this fate is another unanswerable question. Under the category of most prolific murderers, however, the first 12 editions of the Guinness Book of World Records estimated the total at 28, the greatest number of murders ever ascribed to a modern murderess. Just 2 years before the Ganess horrors came to light, the country was riveted by the case of a serial killer every bit as diabolical as Bell. His birth name was Johann Schmidt, but he would assume many others in the course of his malevolent career. Albert Hushberg, Count Otto von Kain, Dr. L. G. Hart, Martin Dotz, Jacob Duss, Henry F. Hartmann, Heinrich Waldsand, and at least a dozen more, including the one by which the world would come to know him. Johann Hoch. A native of Germany, he came to America in 1887 at the age of 25, abandoning a wife and 3 children. In 1895, under the name Huff, he bigamously married a well-off widow named Martha Steinbucher. 4 months later, she fell ill with a devastating intestinal ailment. As she writhed in agony, she told her physician that she had been poisoned, but, attributing the remark to delirium, he paid her no heed. She died the next day. Immediately afterward, her husband sold her property for $4,000 and disappeared. Huff's second murder victim was Caroline Hoke of Wheeling, West Virginia, who was hit with a violent illness shortly after their wedding. On a visit to the stricken woman, her minister surprised Huff in the act of giving his wife some white powder, presumably medicine. The next day, Caroline was dead. Huff immediately sold the house, claimed his wife's $900 insurance policy, then faked his own suicide and disappeared. Now calling himself Johann Hoch, the killer made his way to Chicago. Along the way, he preyed on an indeterminate number of women, murdering some, merely fleecing and abandoning others. For a while, he worked in the Chicago stockyards, an occupation that would ultimately earn him his homicidal nickname, the Stockyard Bluebeard. In December 1904, Hook placed a matrimonial ad in a German newspaper and, soon afterward, received a reply from a 46-year-old widow, Marie Walker, who owned a small candy store. They were married a short time later. A week after the wedding, Marie was stricken with excruciating abdominal pains, a violent thirst, and a tingling in her extremities that felt, she said, like ants crawling over her flesh. All classic symptoms of arsenic poisoning. Her physician, however, diagnosed the problem as nephritis. She died 2 weeks later. No sooner had Marie exhaled her last, agonized breath, than Hoke proposed to her sister Julia, who had come to tend her dying sibling. 3 days later, Hoke and Julia were married. Hoke soon disappeared with all of Julia's money. While notifying the police, Julia learned that Hoke was already under suspicion for swindle and murder. Caroline Hoke's body had previously been exhumed, but examiners were unable to determine if there was poison in her stomach because Hoke had taken the precaution of eviscerating the corpse and dumping the organs into the Ohio River. Authorities had better luck with the body of Marie Walker. A postmortem turned up lethal traces of arsenic in her viscera. Police immediately distributed the fugitive's photograph. Hoke, who had fled to New York City, was arrested when his landlady recognized his picture in the papers. When the police arrested him, they found a fountain pen in his possession. Instead of ink, the reservoir contained 58 grains of a powdered substance that turned out to be arsenic. He was convicted of the murder of Marie Walker and hanged on February 23, 1906. The number of his victims is unknown, though his most trustworthy chronicler estimates that Hoke married between 43 and 50 women, about a third of whom he murdered. As soon as the enormity of Belle's crimes became clear, stories comparing her to Johann Hoke began to appear in the papers. The strangest of these was a widely syndicated article headlined, "If Their Paths Had Crossed," a piece of alternate history inspired by the speculations of Charles Peters, Deputy Chief Sheriff of Chicago. It would have been interesting from a criminological point of view to watch a contest between Mrs. Ganess and Hoke, Peters mused to reporters. Suppose that Hoke had seen one of her advertisements, answered it, and a meeting had been arranged. She would have been after Hoke's money, and he would have been after hers. Then would have come the contest, each plotting, scheming with all of his or her cleverness to get the better of the other. It would have beaten any drama of villainy ever produced on the stage. Elaborating on Peters's macabre what-if scenario, the article described in lurid detail the imaginary encounter of the male and female Bluebeards. Replying to Mrs. Ganess's ad, Hoke would have grinned in ghoulish glee as he pictured the rich farm soon to come into his possession. Belle would have read Hoke's response with a cruel smile upon her face, then glanced out of the back window into that graveyard of mutilated victims and figured out where she could bury one more. At their first meeting, each would have sized each other up and decided, "This one will be easy." On the following day, Belle would have carelessly held his hand or patted his cheek as she showed him over the acres. He would have returned the caress, believing that his appearance and winning mannerisms had already made an impression. Soon they would be discussing finances. Hoke would have told the widow he had thousands of dollars with him to be put into the common fund. She would have smiled and answered that her farm would belong to him when they were married. Possibly, right there, they would have set the date for the wedding. Once they had completed their nuptials and taken a brief honeymoon tour, the couple would have returned to the farm where the curtain on the last act would have been raised, and their fiendish plotting would reach its tragical climax. As for the winner of this grim contest between the two matrimonial monsters, the writer could only speculate. Which would have outwitted the other? Who would have found the first opening to strike, either with poison at a meal, an axe in the darkness of night, or a dagger while in a loving embrace? Which of them would now be under the ground, the victim of the other's treachery, and which enjoying the money of the other? If Belle's crimes resembled those of Johann Hoke, they also called up memories of another notorious case, that of the Bloody Benders of Kansas. The Bender family consisted of the 60-year-old patriarch, John, a hulking, heavily bearded man, generally referred to simply as Old Man Bender in historical accounts. His wife, known only as Ma, a stout, homely female in her 50s with a tallow-white face and a temperament every bit as surly as her husband's. John Jr., a slender young man in his mid-20s, with a pleasant face, a trim mustache, and a way of breaking into sudden nervous giggles that led some people to regard him as a simpleton. And a daughter named Kate, a young woman in her early 20s who, by default, was considered the brains of the operation. Though Kate has gone down in legend as a red-haired temptress, she appears to have been a ruddy-faced, mannish-looking female who held seances under the name Professor Miss Kate Bender, and claimed to be a faith healer. Sometime around 1870, the Bender family arrived in Labette County, Kansas, and built a home along a stretch of road a few miles south of the railway town of Cherryvale. The dwelling was little more than a one-room log box, 16 by 20 feet in size. The interior was divided in half by a canvas curtain. One side served as the family's living quarters. The other was turned into a rudimentary inn, where wayfarers could enjoy a home-cooked meal and a straw mattress on the floor for those who wished to bed down for the night. No one knows how many guests the Benders entertained during the 2 years they ran their ghastly roadhouse, but at least 9 of them were never seen alive again. Their dreadful fate was uncovered in the spring of 1873, following the mysterious disappearance of a prominent local physician named William York, last seen traveling by buggy along the Osage Trail. A search party led by the doctor's brother, Colonel A.M. York, traced his movements to the Bender homestead. Questioned by Colonel York, John Jr. confirmed that the doctor had in fact spent a night at the inn, but insisted that he had departed in good health the following morning. Claiming that he himself had recently escaped an ambush by highwaymen, John suggested that the doctor might have fallen victim to the gang, a theory Colonel York found highly implausible. After questioning Kate, who offered to use her clairvoyant gifts to find the missing man, the colonel and his men took their leave. It was clear, however, that their suspicions had been deeply aroused. Some weeks later, a neighbor of the Benders rode over to the inn and was surprised to discover that the place was deserted. From the mess strewn around inside, dirty dishes, an old clock, a German Bible, some hammers, a meat saw, a long-bladed knife, and the canvas partition which lay bundled in a corner, it seemed clear that the Benders had abandoned their home in a hurry. When word of this development reached Colonel York, he lost no time in assembling a group of men and making straight for the inn. According to some chroniclers, it was York who discovered the trapdoor in the floor of what had been the Benders' kitchen area. The moment it was lifted, a dreadful odor assaulted his nostrils. Closer inspection revealed the source of the terrible stench, a pool of dried blood caked on the stone floor. Prying up the entire cabin with stout poles, the men managed to move it clear of its foundation. With the cellar exposed, they used sledgehammers to shatter the stone floor, but found nothing beneath. By the light of the late afternoon sun, however, one of the men spotted something suspicious in the soil of the nearby apple orchard, a strange rectangular depression, like a slightly sunken grave. He called out to the others, who grabbed shovels and spades and began digging. In less than a minute, they had uncovered the remains of a partly clothed man lying face down in the dirt. The base of his skull was completely bashed in. When the men turned the body over, they saw that the throat had been slashed from ear to ear. Despite its badly decomposed state, Colonel York had no trouble identifying the corpse as his missing brother William. By then, darkness had fallen. Early the next morning, the men returned to the spot and, using metal rods to probe the soil, conducted a thorough search of the orchard. By the time they were done, they had unearthed 8 more bodies, all but one of them adult males, subsequently identified as travelers along the Osage Trail, who had never reached their destinations. They were all known to have been carrying substantial amounts of cash and had all died in the identical manner, the base of their skulls crushed, their throats slit. The single exception was an 8-year-old girl, Marianne Launcher, found beside her father's corpse with a silk scarf bound tightly around her neck. A post-mortem exam determined that she had been strangled to the point of unconsciousness, then buried alive. From the physical evidence, the size and shape of the men's head wounds, the matching dimensions of the hammers found in the cabin, certain telltale stains on the canvas curtain, as well as from the testimony of several people who had survived stays at the inn, a picture emerged of the Bender's diabolical M.O. When a prosperous-looking traveler showed up, he would be ushered into the dining area and seated at the table with his back to the canvas divider. While Kate beguiled him with some dinner-time conversation, her father or brother would be lurking on the other side of the curtain, hammer at the ready. When the unsuspecting guest leaned his head back against the curtain, the hammer would come crashing down, shattering the back of his skull. The body would then be dragged to the rear of the cabin where it would be robbed, stripped, and dumped through the trapdoor into the cellar. There his throat would be slit for good measure. Later the body would be taken out and buried in the orchard. $3,000 in reward money was offered for the apprehension of the fugitives. Despite a massive manhunt by lawmen, bounty hunters, and assorted vigilantes, however, the Benders eluded arrest. Rumors about their whereabouts would circulate for years, that John Jr. was working on a railroad gang in Texas, that Kate was running a brothel in San Francisco, that Pa Bender had committed suicide in Michigan, that the whole family had perished while attempting to cross into Mexico via hot air balloon. But their fate remained a mystery. Following the ghastly discoveries on the Ganess farm, newspapers were quick to note the remarkable parallelism between Bell's atrocities and the notorious doings of the Bender family. Indeed, so similar did the two cases appear in certain respects that wild rumors began to circulate about possible connections between Bell and the Benders. One widely printed article cited an anonymous correspondent who sent a letter to the editor of a Louisville, Kentucky newspaper, claiming that Bell and Kate Bender were related by blood, Kate's father being a brother to Mrs. Ganess's grandfather. Another writer ventured an even more remarkable theory, that Mrs. Ganess was Kate Bender. If such were the case, she has outdone the ghastly achievements of her former life. However appalling the Bender crimes, the tally of their victims had already been surpassed by the findings in Bell's hog lot. Moreover, the Benders had the support of one another, the terrible relief which comes to those who share a fatal secret. By contrast, while Mrs. Ganess may have had an accomplice in Lamphere or another, it seemed equally likely that many, if not most of her crimes, were committed by her alone. However dubious the notion that the vanished Kate Bender had reappeared 3 decades later under a new identity in La Porte, there was no doubt in the mind of the writer that she and Bell Ganess would forever be linked in the history of crime. Both had achieved a terrible immortality, leaving names at which the world may well grow pale, and their enormities revealed a sobering truth, that the possibilities of the human heart seem infinite in evil as in good. 23. Dead or Alive? On Friday, May 8th, E.R. Buell and A.J. Hunt, commercial travelers from Detroit, were seated beside each other in a Pullman car on the Atlantic Express, headed for Rochester, New York. At around 7 o'clock in the evening, the train made a stop at Ashtabula, Ohio, where a woman boarded and took a seat across the aisle from the two men. She was a large woman, perhaps 5 feet 9 inches in height, and weighing, from the looks of her, about 200 pounds. She was dressed in widow's weeds and wore a heavy black veil. Buell would later tell reporters that there was something peculiar about her behavior, that she seemed eager to avoid attention on the car. Both men had recently been in Chicago and were keenly aware of the Ganess case and the conflicting opinions as to Bell's fate. In fact, Buell was carrying a copy of one of the Chicago papers with a large photograph of the female Bluebeard on its front page. At some point during the trip, the woman lifted her veil. At the sight of her face, the two salesmen exchanged a look. When they arrived in Rochester, Buell and his companion proceeded straight to the Powers Hotel, where they informed the house detective of their suspicions. The detective immediately telephoned the police lieutenant, Henry R. McAllister, who in turn put in a call to Captain Thomas R. Quigley in Syracuse, where the train would be making its next stop. Quigley promptly dispatched two of his detectives, Carl Nice and John Donovan, to meet the train when it arrived. It was a few minutes before 1 a.m. when it pulled into the Syracuse depot. Accompanied by the station master, the two detectives boarded the train and spoke to the Pullman car conductor, O.S. Britton. They described the woman in black who had gotten on at Ashtabula and asked if she was still on board. When Britton inquired if they were friends of the woman, Nice and Donovan displayed their credentials and explained the reason they were there. Britton immediately led them to the lower berth, where the woman lay sleeping. She would later describe the terrible sensation that had come over her when she was awakened by two men's heads peering into her berth. Her first thought was that the train was being held up by robbers. When they identified themselves and told her why they were there, she was dumbfounded. They ordered her to dress immediately. She was still making herself ready, however, when the train, already 15 minutes past its scheduled departure time, chugged out of the station. The officers rode with her all the way to Utica, where they led her onto the platform, loaded her into a hack, and drove her to police headquarters. By then, word of the detective's mission had spread throughout the train, generating intense excitement among the passengers, who felt they had been present at a historical event, the capture of the country's most notorious fugitive, the Indiana ogress, Belle Ganess. That morning, Saturday, May 9th, headlines around the country trumpeted the news. Even as the public was learning of Belle's arrest, however, police in upstate New York were admitting to an embarrassing blunder. The woman taken from the train, as she had no trouble proving, was Mrs. Cora Herron, widow of the recently deceased Frederick B. Herron, former president of the Cephnus Chemical Company of Chicago. She was on her way to New York City to visit her sister, Mrs. Etta V. Rockefeller of West 40th Street, wife of a streetcar conductor who claimed a distant kinship with the oil tycoon. Having established her identity to the satisfaction of the Utica authorities, Mrs. Herron was taken back to Syracuse where, after sending a telegram to her sister, she spent the remainder of the night in the matron's quarters of police headquarters. Early the following morning, she was interviewed by Police Chief Condon, who offered his apologies and asked her to sign a release relieving his department of responsibility for the false arrest, a request she refused. She was then driven to the train station and given a ticket on the Empire Express to New York City. Waiting to meet her at the Grand Central Station were her sister, Mrs. Rockefeller, and reporters from various papers, including the New York Times. "This is a dreadful thing," Mrs. Rockefeller angrily declared after she and Mrs. Herron had exchanged an emotional greeting, "and I shall encourage my sister to seek legal redress for the stigma that the stupid Syracuse detectives have placed on her." Asked how much she intended to sue for, an exhausted Mrs. Herron named $50,000 as the sum she felt she was entitled to. As Mrs. Herron climbed into a taxi for the short ride to her sister's apartment, the Times reporter called out, "Won't you say something about your experience?"
"Oh, what can I say?" she replied in a tremulous voice. "It is too awful."
It came as no surprise to Deputy Sheriff Antis that the Syracuse police had nabbed the wrong woman. Like others in LaPorte, he remained firmly convinced that Belle Ganess was dead, slain by her sometime accomplice, Ray Lamphere. Reinforced by a trio of Pinkerton detectives brought in to aid the investigation, the LaPorte Sheriff's Department had, according to Antis, already gathered enough evidence to hang Lamphere on a charge of murder. Every restless night that Ray passed behind bars was reported in the press as indisputable proof of his guilt-stricken conscience. With its standard shameless disregard for verifiable fact, the Chicago American portrayed him as a raving maniac, driven to madness by Mrs. Ganess's vengeful specter, come to haunt him in his cell.
"She's pointing a finger at me," Lamphere cries out at night. "She is saying, 'I'll get you yet, I'll get you yet. I can't get away from her.'"
Rebutting Antis's claim, Ray's attorney, Wirt Warden, issued a statement asserting his client's innocence. Having represented Ray in the various suits brought against him by Mrs. Ganess, Warden proclaimed that, though undeniably a man of mediocre mentality, Lamphere was without criminal proclivities. "There are two reasonable theories as to the cause and origin of the fire," he continued. "One is that Mrs. Ganess, thinking that Lamphere may have discovered things that would incriminate her, and knowing further that Ocelot Helgeline was coming to make an investigation,
sought to cover up all evidence of her crimes and escape with her own life, if possible, and that she, in carrying this out, murdered the three children, placed them on the cellar floor with the adult corpse found, and fired the building and escaped. The other theory is that Mrs. Ganesse, foreseeing the culminating of events upon the arrival of Helgeline, decided to end her own life, and at the same time cover up all evidence of prior crimes, and to do so, killed her own children, fired the house, and committed suicide. In either event, Warden concluded, Lamphere, as I firmly believe, is innocent of any crime. He is simply a victim of circumstance. Proponents of Warden's first theory, that the headless woman found in the cellar was a decoy planted by Bell, were bolstered in their belief by the many reported sightings of the murderess. Police in Elkhart, Indiana, were on the lookout for a woman weighing about 200 pounds and of distinctly masculine appearance, who had aroused the suspicion of a bookstore clerk named Stillman when he noticed that she spoke in a Scandinavian accent and had a number of gold teeth that matched the description of the LaPorte archfiend. George G. Spiranevsky, a druggist in East St. Louis, contacted the police to report that a woman answering the description of Mrs. Belle Ganesse had recently taken up residence in his city. Sheriff R.S. Williams of Delta County, Colorado, convinced that Mrs. Ganesse had settled nearby, telegraphed the authorities in LaPorte, asking if any reward was being offered for her capture so that he might proceed with her arrest. Another telegram to the LaPorte police, this one from a resident in Wilmar, Minnesota, claimed that Mrs. Ganesse was currently working as a housekeeper for a local farmer and urged them to come and get her. Samuel Harvey of Kansas City, Missouri, wrote directly to Mayor Darrow, saying he had met Mrs. Ganesse in Ogden, Utah on May 4th, 6 days after she was supposedly burned to death. She was also seen in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Palouse, Washington, Hot Springs, Arkansas, Cincinnati, Ohio, Joliet, Illinois, Alberta, Canada, and traveling through the wilds of the state of Chiapas, Mexico, dressed in man's attire. Closer to home, a self-declared seer named Jesse Dickinson appeared at Sheriff Smutzer's office on Saturday, May 9th, announcing that Belle Ganesse was still in LaPorte County and that he had the power to locate her. All I require, he said, is something that has been in the possession of Ray Lamphere, and by the aid of this I will be able to tell the exact location of her hiding place, and the mystery will be solved. Another person claiming spiritualistic powers, Mrs. A. James of South Milwaukee, announced that by studying the signs of the zodiac, she had discovered that Mrs. Ganesse was presently living either in Michigan City, Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, or Terre Haute. She will be found in a livery barn in one of these cities, dressed as a man and doing man's work. Sightings of Belle became such a common occurrence that the press began treating them as a joke. One Indiana newspaper advised all large-sized women to stay at home so that they are not mistaken for Mrs. Ganesse and held by the authorities. Another wryly observed that Belle had been seen in so many different places at almost the same time that she seemed to have solved the problem of rapid transit. Sheriff Smutzer, still convinced that Belle was dead, had come up with a novel way to prove it, an original departure from the methods usually employed in the work of solving murder mysteries, as one Chicago paper wrote. Late Saturday, May 9th, he announced that he had retained the services of a veteran miner named Louis Schultz, who had spent nearly 20 years among the gulches of California and Colorado prospecting for gold. On Monday, Schultz would set up his sluice on the Ganesse property and begin sifting the ashes in the cellar in a search for Belle's gold-capped teeth. "I will take my time," said Schultz, "and go over every particle of the wreckage. If the teeth are there, I will find them. And if it was Mrs. Ganesse who perished in the flames, the teeth are there." Belle's dentist, Dr. Ira P. Norton, agreed with Schultz. "Mrs. Ganesse had some dental work done by me a year ago. She made 2 visits and paid me $40 for my work," he told reporters. "The 4 incisors in her lower jaw were missing. I put gold crowns on the 2 lower bicuspids and bridged in 4 porcelain teeth between them. The 4 porcelain teeth were reinforced by a back of 18-karat gold. If it was Mrs. Ganesse whose body was found in the ruins, her teeth are intact among the debris. The fire was not hot enough to melt the gold or incinerate the porcelain."
Smutzer's announcement came at the end of a long and fruitless day of digging. For the first time since he and his helpers began their grim excavations, Bell's Garden of Death yielded no new bodies. When the search was abandoned at nightfall, the crowds that had gathered at the farm since early morning couldn't hide their surprise. By then, Bell had assumed such monstrous dimensions in the public imagination that it was generally assumed she had sown every square yard of her 30-acre farm with the bodies of her victims. No digging was planned for the next day, partly in honor of the Sabbath, but mostly because of the immense hordes that were expected to descend on the farm. Guards would be posted in the cellar and on the ruins of the farmhouse, but otherwise, spectators would be allowed to roam at will. To cash in on the Ganesh-related frenzy, the Lake Erie and Western Railroad had arranged for special excursion trains to bring visitors from Indianapolis and Chicago. Every hotel room in LaPorte and nearby Michigan City had been booked, and extra cots set up in the hallways. Restaurants were doing a booming business. Generally speaking, one local newspaper observed, the town presents the appearance of a fair or big convention. Livery companies were hiring additional drivers to ferry sightseers to and from the Ganesh place. They would have countless round trips to make. According to one estimate, at least 10,000 people, the equivalent of 3/4 of the population of LaPorte, were expected to flock to the murder farm on Sunday to gratify their morbid curiosity. 24. Carnival. The predictions published in the Saturday papers were wrong. 10,000 people did not descend on the Ganesh farm on Sunday, May 10th. According to the most reliable estimates, the number was closer to 16,000, and possibly as high as 20. The first excursion train reached LaPorte just after 5 o'clock in the morning. Others, packed to overflowing, arrived regularly throughout the day, disgorging passengers by the hundreds. Local hackmen were waiting at the station, ready to take the new arrivals out to the farm. The standard fare was 10 cents for the one-mile ride. Once there, the passengers were informed that the return trip would cost them a quarter. By mid-morning, the Macung-Macadam Road was jammed with every variety of vehicle, carry-alls, buggies, brooms, buckboards, wagonettes, and more, along with an army of pedestrians. An estimated 50 automobiles brought smartly dressed visitors from Chicago, Michigan City, South Bend, Elkhart, Goshen, Niles, Mishawaka, and other Midwestern cities. Young men on bicycles, new mothers pushing baby carriages, and old-timers hobbling along on crutches vied with each other for a place on the road, while motorcycles shot through the crowds at frequent intervals. Given the congestion, it seemed a miracle that only a single accident occurred, when an automobile spooked the horse pulling the buggy of Benjamin Zanilar and his wife, and Mrs. Zanilar was thrown from the rig and broke an arm. A festive atmosphere reigned at the farm. Newspaper commentators compared the scene to a county fair, a playground, and a Sunday amusement park. Vendors, calling their wares through megaphones, peddled peanuts, popcorn, and lemonade. Beside one of the graves, where the moldering remains of two of Bell's victims had been unearthed, a portly fellow manned a makeshift refreshment stand, dispensing pink ice cream and cake. A crew of young men, hired for the occasion by a local printer, roamed the grounds, hawking picture postcards at 10 cents apiece, or 3 for a quarter. The photos of Andrew Helgeline's dismembered body sold out within minutes, though the ones showing the skulls of Bell's other victims were also popular. Other subjects included portraits of Bell and her children, panoramic views of the farmstead, and images of shovel-wielding diggers standing knee-deep in the graves. Many visitors brought Kodaks and took their own photos, posing their families before the ruins of Bell's farmhouse or at the edges of the pits in the excavated hog lot. Several enterprising youngsters went around offering human skeletal fragments allegedly dug from the Death Garden, though the people who snapped up these supposed relics would eventually learn that they had purchased the bone shards of pigs. Other eager souvenir hunters came away with whatever treasures they could get their hands on, chunks of brick from the incinerated house, charred pieces of stovepipe, bent nails, burnt shoe buttons, even twigs from the orchard. Joe Zahner, member of the South Bend Baseball Club, secured an old coffee pot and a disreputable-looking shoe. Ignoring the guards posted at the site, scavengers climbed into the ruins of the cellar and emerged with whole bagfuls of debris. Other men hopped into the open graves and groveled in the dirt for ghoulish keepsakes. One handsome young woman was seen with the skirt of her beautiful dress lifted up, in which she carried about part of the carcass of a dead dog, supposed to have been killed by Mrs. Ganesh while she was experimenting with poisons to use on her victims. The earliest arrivals to the farm made straight for the buggy shed, where the reeking remains of the exhumed corpses were laid out on wooden planks. Sheriff Smutzer, standing guard outside, lined the visitors up in single file and allowed them into the makeshift morgue a few at a time. By 9 o'clock, however, the crowd pressing for admission became so large and unmanageable that Smutzer was compelled to padlock the door. Sending up cries of frustration, several women clawed at the little red carriage house. They stuck their fingers in the cracks and wrenched in an attempt to pry them apart far enough to see inside, while men boosted each other to the window at the end of the structure and gazed until others pushed them from their places to make room for other gawkers. It was a perfect day for a picnic, and many of the families who arrived in the morning brought along lunch baskets. At noontime they spread tablecloths on the lawn beneath the fir trees in the front yard or on the grass of the apple orchard and settled down for their meals. Laughing children darted among the crowds or trooped alongside a local character, Uncle Ben, who roamed the property with a forked willow divining rod that could, so he claimed, detect the graves of undiscovered victims. 37 in all, he solemnly announced to reporters at the conclusion of his search. The holiday scene at the Ganesh farm was not only front-page news across the Midwest, but the subject of widespread moralizing. For 2 weeks, papers had been gleefully exploiting the tragedy. Suddenly, their editorial pages rang with indignation at the unseemly behavior of the crowds who had defiled the Sabbath by turning the murder farm into a carnival ground. The normal Sunday atmosphere of quietude and religious observance had been supplanted by noisy merrymaking and wild frolic, ribald rioting and coarse and disgusting and almost insane frivolity. Such was the air of festivity that one would have thought the Ganesh farm contained a circus rather than a murder morgue. To one outraged commentator, the mad scramble of 15,000 people to the site of such appalling and atrocious crimes was a sad commentary on the moral state of supposedly civilized man. Galling, incontrovertible proof that the race is still but a little removed from a stage of actual savagery. Stung by these attacks, the editor of the LaPorte Weekly Herald defended his community, arguing that the hordes of morbid sightseers at the Ganesh farm deserve no special censure, for the same would doubtless have been true of people from any other section of the state or the country. The ghoulish spectacle was merely a magnified reflection of what transpires almost every day in every community. Our police courts are always crowded with people eager to brush against crime. The morgue is the center of attraction. Relics of a murder or of a terrible accident entailing the loss of life are eagerly collected and given a conspicuous place in many homes. How to account for this unhealthy appetite for the horrible? Perhaps, the writer suggested, there was some strange comfort to be derived from the awareness of another suffering. One would think there was enough unavoidable tragedy in everyone's existence to keep him from seeking the hideous and unsightly, he mused. And yet it may be the fact that each has his cross to bear that leads him to come in contact with the world's wretchedness as a sort of palliative to his own. Whatever the case, the public's fascination with every grisly detail of the Ganesh case would continue unabated, as would the efforts of various hucksters to profit from it. The following Sunday would bring 10,000 sightseers to the farm. A few days later, an editorial in the LaPorte Weekly noted with outrage that two theaters in South Bend were presenting a magic lantern show consisting of 22 views of the Ganesh farm. Next, the writer continued with bitter sarcasm, they will probably be showing moving pictures of Mrs. Ganesh murdering her victims. His comment proved prescient. Not long afterward, theaters throughout the Midwest began showing a moving picture produced by the Edison Company titled Mrs. Ganesh, the Female Bluebeard. 25. The Mrs. Ganesh Mystery. The public couldn't get enough of the Ganesh case. In LaPorte, the printing presses worked overtime to meet the demand for the two local papers. The daily run of the Herald rose by as much as 800 copies, many readers buying three or four extra copies of every issue, one for themselves, the others, to send away to friends. In Chicago, the appetite for every juicy tidbit about the case was fed by the yellow papers, which, when no actual news was available, cheerfully dished out wild rumor, lurid gossip, and even rank fabrication. According to one Chicago daily, Mrs. Ganesh was a grave robber who stole a body from Pine Lake Cemetery near her home and substituted it for her own in the burning house. Another reported that she was a hypnotist who was possessed of some remarkable power to compel unwilling victims to do what she commanded. In a syndicated piece headlined, "The Horrors of That Night," a writer named Robert Ashe depicted the multi-murderess as a guilt-haunted wreck, tormented nightly by the ghosts of her victims. For months following the deaths of her victims, the archfiend suffered the torments of the condemned. The woman's dreams were troubled. Specters of Helgeline, of Jenny Olson, of 10 crumbling skeletons haunted her. Darkness was filled with horror for the woman. In nightly delirium, the wraiths of the victims of the death farm passed in review before her. Citing sources in Norway, one widely circulated story claimed that Bell's father, Peter Paulson, was a traveling conjurer and magician who performed at fairs throughout the country. Along with her three sisters and brothers, Bell also took part in the show, performing in front of the tent as a rope dancer in short skirts to entice male customers inside. One of Bell's most diabolical letters to Andrew Helgeline was reprinted in newspapers across the country. "No woman in the world is happier than I am," it read in part. "I know that you are now to come to me and be my own. When I hear your name mentioned, it is beautiful music to my ears. My heart beats with wild rapture for you. My Andrew, I love you. Come prepared to stay forever." Only many years later would researchers determine that this sinister missive was a fake, concocted by one or more of the out-of-town newspaper men holed up at the Hotel Tea Garden. Several Indiana communities seemed seized by a perverse envy. When rumors spread that a new death farm, where Mrs. Bell Ganesh buried many of her victims, had been discovered near Warsaw, the citizens of that place were thrown into a fever excitement, and appeared crestfallen when the story proved false. In Valparaiso, one newspaper reported that, before purchasing her farm in LaPorte, "Mrs. Ganesh wrote to one of our citizens inquiring about the price of a piece of land which he had for sale. Evidently she intended to start her private graveyard near this city. For unknown reasons, however, the negotiations fell through. Thus," the article somewhat wistfully concluded, "our city missed a chance to gain worldwide notoriety." Jacob Rauch, a 70-year-old resident of Warsaw, was said to have become so obsessed by the Ganesh case that he went temporarily insane and, while in that condition, took his own life. Even weirder was a story in the New York Times headlined, "Dog Ganesh Hurt Her Lawn." According to the article, Mrs. Sarah D. Stubbard of Glenridge, New Jersey, had rented her handsome home to a Manhattanite named F.H. Sawyer. When she returned to take possession of her home, Mrs. Stubbard, who had always taken pride in her lawn, was shocked to find the beautiful plot marred by Mr. Sawyer's dog, Jip, who had emulated Mrs. Ganesh by burying bones in the lawn. Mrs. Stubbard promptly brought a suit against Mr. Sawyer for $500 in damages wrought by his canine Ganesh. The wildest tales of all appeared in a paperback true crime book, hastily slapped together by some anonymous hack, and published that summer by the Chicago firm of Thompson and Thomas. Priced at a quarter, this shameless cut-and-paste job, a mess of undigested newspaper clippings spiced up with red-hot imaginary episodes, as one historian describes it, was titled "The Mrs. Ganesh Mystery, A Thrilling Tale of Love, Duplicity, and Crime." On its lurid cover, Bell, depicted as a statuesque beauty in a filmy nightgown, hovers over the bed of a slumbering farmhand, a candle held aloft in one of her hands, a bottle of poison clutched in the other. The prurient quality of the image prevails throughout the book, which opens with a chapter on Belle's ostensible childhood titled The Sword Swallower's Daughter. "It was a gala day in the gypsy camp near Trondheim, Norway," the chapter begins, "when Peter, the giant sword swallower, won the hand in marriage of the svelte little Arabella, whose tiny pointed toes, dancing upon a swinging rope high in the air, had set the nation on fire with enthusiasm." We learn how the dashing and handsome Peter swept the pretty Arabella off her feet by demonstrating his amazing skill at sword swallowing, burying a long steel blade into the human sheath of his throat until only its jeweled hilt was visible between his teeth. The brute horror of it fascinated the dancer. With the strange trait that characterizes her sex, Arabella found herself falling in love with this daring giant. Soon Arabella was serving as Peter's assistant in a new act he had invented called the decapitation, in which he created the shockingly realistic illusion that he was beheading his lovely young wife. The properties for the act were a great sword, a chopping block, a cheval mirror, and a head of wax fashioned to resemble the features of his pretty wife. Clad in the blood-red tights and the black mask of the headsman, Peter would stand upon a platform beside the gruesome block, while the pretty Arabella laid her golden head upon its surface. Then, to the horror of the spectators, he would feel with his fingers for the white throat of the woman. A dazzling flash of the steel blade, and down it came with a sickening crunch. A spurt of property blood, and the head of the beauty dropped from the block into a basket before it. Before the crowd could recover from their thrill of horror, the woman would arise from behind the block, smile at them with her dazzling teeth to prove that a dummy and not her real head had been clipped off, and throw them a kiss. One year after their marriage, a baby girl was born to the couple. She was christened Arabella after her mother, but everybody called her Baby Bella. Accompanying her parents on their yearly round of the towns in Norway and Sweden, the blue-eyed Moppet was soon emulating them in her own games of make-believe. One day, the big showman and his wife came upon their little daughter seated at the rear of their gypsy tent, prattling merrily to her one childish treasure, a rag doll named Dolly. As the parents looked on in horror, Baby Bella reached for one of her father's swords and, with a gurgle of delight, chopped off Dolly's head. So shocked were Peter and Arabella by this behavior that they temporarily retired from show business and opened a crockery shop in Christiana. Not long afterward, during a visit from her grandfather, the child saw the old man meet a violent death when he tumbled from the top landing of the stairs, where she stood, to the floor below, and broke his neck. The worst, according to the book, was yet to come. Peter's crockery venture having failed, he was forced back into his old business of sword swallowing. One day, as he stood before a great crowd and thrust a razor-edged blade into his vitals, he slipped and fell. The point of the knife was driven through his bowels. Baby Bella saw her father die in terrible agony. Though couched in characteristically overwrought language, the chapter concludes with a question that continues to dominate debates over the relative influence of nature and nurture in the creation of serial murderers. Was it hereditary, or was it childish association with horror that led this child to grow into an ogress, with the lust for letting human blood, the love of rending of bodies limb from limb, and the greed for human heads that caused her to slay and decapitate at least 25 children, women, and men whose names are known? The heart of the book is a wildly sensationalistic account of Belle's crimes, much of it plagiarized from the newspapers, the rest made up out of whole, highly colorful cloth. After dispatching her two husbands, Belle, variously referred to as the sword swallower's daughter, the sorceress, the siren, the ogress, and the bloodthirsty monster Mrs. Hyde, set about devising a cunning murder machine, baiting her trap to satisfy the wild bloodlust that hungers in her heart. The first step was the construction of a dungeon chamber on her LaPorte property. Soon after moving in, she hired a mason to build an ostensible smokehouse, with soundproof walls, no windows, and a heavy oaken door.
She then equipped her intended murder room with meat hooks and a vat, appurtenances that might be used in cutting up and making sausage or dismembering a human body. Next came the purchase of the other accessories to this murder machine, some arsenic, a bottle of chloroform, a few keen-edged scalpels and dissecting knives. The final step was creating a death garden, a little private murder cemetery where she could plant the bones of her victims. At last, she was prepared to enter the wholesale murder business. Putting her diabolical plan in motion, she sent myriads of letters into the world, love letters palpitating with passion, seductive in their hints at the fortune any man might have in marriage. It wasn't long before the moths flocked to her flame. In describing her atrocities, the nameless scribe pulls out all the salacious stops, rendering the scenes in the quasi-pornographic style of a Victorian penny dreadful. Typical is his depiction of the ostensible dual murder on Christmas Eve 1906 of Belle's foster daughter Jenny Olson and the Minnesota bachelor John Moe. Cat-like, softly as a tigress stalking her prey, the sword swallower's daughter sought the chamber of the virgin girl. Light fingers felt the soft white throat. A half-smothered scream and a childish treble, and all was over. Now the tigress emerged and tiptoed to the room of Mr. Moe. From the belt beneath her nightgown she drew a tiny vial. No need for caution now. The man was drugged with wine. Her eyes were small steel points. Her nostrils quivered with the scent for blood. Her hands were talons. Her face was a horrid gargoyle. By candlelight, Mrs. Hyde sat in the crimson-papered guest chamber and reveled in the final struggles of her prey. Down to the dungeon chamber she lugged the heavy bodies. Down on the chopping block she laid the lifeless forms. With the sure, quick work of the adept, she stripped them of clothing. She raised above her shoulders the keen blade of a huge meat axe. Quick, sure, clean as the work of the surgeon was Belle's dismemberment. Conscienceless, trembling not, void of emotion, she separated limb from limb the slender form of the girl she had nursed from a babe. Once the bodies were planted in her death garden, the fictional Belle would sprinkle them with chloride of lime to destroy all traces of her monstrous handiwork. Every day, the acid was eating away the evidence, devouring bones, hair, flesh, carrying on the labors that the widow, with fiendish ingenuity, had begun. Even as the acid did its work, Belle's thirst for blood and her itch for gold grew on apace. Seating herself at her table, she composed one of her diabolical love letters, then, smiling a vulture's grin as her tongue tip wet the stamp, mailed it off to her next unwitting victim. Soon, there was another blood orgy, a bit of powder on a silver spoon, a groan, a rattling in the throat, a swift, deft surgery that clicked bone from bone as the chef carves a capon for the table, the midnight burial in the little garden, and the lime did the rest. Tallying Belle's victims, the writer asserted that she was responsible for 25 known murders and suspected of as many as 50. The depredations of America's other notorious multi-murderers paled by comparison. The Bender family, operating a murder ranch in Kansas, had but 8 known victims. Dr. H.H. Holmes of Murder Castle fame killed not more than a score in all. Hoke, the arch-bigamist, killed but 10. The numbers spoke for themselves. Belle Ganess, the sorceress of Murder Farm, was, by a wide margin, the most terrible criminal of the ages. 26. Pay Dirt. The white-haired prospector Louis Schultz, known to his friends as Old Klondike, spent Monday, May 11th, constructing his sluice box, a narrow wooden trough about 12 feet in length and arranged at a downward angle on the ground. While he worked, Joe Maxson and a few other men began hauling shovelfuls of ashes from the cellar of the incinerated farmhouse and dumping them in a big pile beside the contraption. The next day, with a water wagon supplying the necessary stream,
Schultz began the process of washing the debris in search of Bell's gold teeth. In the weeks since the fire, diggers in the cellar had turned up three men's watches. From its serial number, one had been traced to a store in Iola, Kansas, where, so the ledger showed, it had been purchased by